As I have mentioned previously, our internationalization originally started with the aspiration to catch up with the Western civilization in the late 1860s, not only in the areas of economic development, but in every respect. But after Japan waged a desperate and lonely war against 40-odd allied countries, and everything turned to ashes, the government and the private sector jointly concentrated all their efforts in achieving the goal of economic prosperity. This materialistic goal was primary consensus of the Japanese as a whole until recent years, and externally, internationalization was pursued with this objective in mind. I believe that this is the reason why we are often called Japanese Incorporated. Japan Inc.'s performance was successful and admired. But as you might agree with me, Japan Inc. was in many ways a materialistic and profit-oriented body. It often lacked the human element. When we talk about internationalization, I believe mutual understanding between nations and amongst the people of the world is implied as an essential factor. One could say that Japan was in every sense an agricultural economy just until after World War II. Primary industry accounted for approximately 25% of the GNP and employed close to 50% of the labor force. Through World War II, the Japanese lost again everything. We needed to rebuild our nation from scratch. The government introduced the priority production system as an emergency measure. Scarcity of resources for industries after the war directed the government and private sectors to mobilize every resources, raw materials, energy, money, import quotas, everything, to the core industries of steel and coal production, to revive other base industries such as power generation, the national railway system, gas, cement, etc., to restore production. As a result, coupled with other measures and various reforms, including land, agriculture, labor, and education, Japanese industries were prepared in time for the subsequent regional wars in Korea from 50 to 53, and later in Vietnam, that greatly assisted the Japanese economy to take off as one of the major industrial nations in the world. Now, being in banking business, if I may briefly touch upon the banking environment in Japan after the war. Domestically, of course, the post-war period faced an acute shortage of available capital. Money was concentrated in restoring industries. Long-term capital funds were primarily provided by the Development Bank of Japan, a 100% government agency, and the long-term credit banks and trust banks. Short-term funds were, on the other hand, provided to medium to large-scale corporate, primarily by the city banks and the regional banks. At that time, there was a need to establish banks for various different purposes. Aside from the banks mentioned before, we still have today such banks as Mutual Savings Bank, Credit Association, and Credit Cooperatives, totaling 1,000 specializing in servicing small and medium-sized firms and to members, their members and individuals. Further, there is also Norin Chukin Bank, which is powerful financial force based on support from agricultural, forestry and fishery cooperatives, and the Choko Chukin Bank, established by the government to service financing of small businesses. At that time, all foreign exchange was concentrated with the central bank under very strict and complicated foreign exchange and foreign trade law, which was a nightmare for the banks to check transactions for legality. to smooth the way for international trade, the Bank of Tokyo was transformed as the only specialized foreign exchange bank from an ordinary commercial city bank under the foreign exchange banking law in 1954. At the same time, a limited number of branch offices of the other 12 city banks were given licenses to deal in foreign exchange. But in many cases, corporates and individuals, or even the government institutions, relied on Bank of Tokyo's expertise in the areas of technique in dealing in foreign exchange in the market, remittance and trade finance settlements with foreign banks, and interpretation of the law and processing application for the central bank's approval. The workload was very heavy, and overtime exceeding 20 to 30 hours per week on top of normal 48-hour week was not uncommon under the severe working conditions. I understand many of my colleagues collapsed due to fatigue and malnutrition. The most common disease at that time was tuberculosis. But these kind of working conditions were common to other banks as well, and companies too. In developing and expanding international trade during the early post-war period, the trading houses especially, and Export-Import Bank of Japan, and my bank played important roles. However, this one was only possible as the domestic manufacturing and servicing industries' productivity was increasing every year due to their all-out efforts and supported financially by the banks. The Japanese companies in general were very much undercapitalized. They relied heavily on the banks for business expansion and daily operations. Corporate treasurers had to knock on the doors of banks almost every day to secure funds, which were scarce. This is the reason why Japanese companies are still generally highly geared. Internationalization of the Japanese banks started to take shape in the late 1960s to early 1970s by establishing branch offices and representative offices overseas. The overseas presence of Japanese banks has increased more dramatically in the 1980s. On the other hand, with a gradual opening up the financial industry in Japan, at the end of 1987, 81 foreign banks were operating 117 branches, and considerably more had representative offices. More recently, with a high domestic savings rate and a huge current account surplus, together with a consequent appreciation of the yen, the Japanese are recycling huge quantity of capital back into the international market in the form of securities investment, property investment, and shifting part of the manufacturing units overseas. The Japanese government has announced a fund recycling plan which intends to siphon part of the surplus money back into developing countries in the form of an untied loan in a joint effort with the private sector. Expected magnitude of the program is $20 billion in 3 years. This, of course, is different from the usual official development assistance program. I certainly expect the major portion of it to be used for developing purposes in the Asian Pacific region. Internally, Japan developed its own concept and socio-economic structure. Though it should not be over-exaggerated, if you associate with Japanese or a Japanese firm, you would soon find in this modern industrial country a lot of customs and practice you would have difficulty in understanding and coping with. These aspects were perhaps often pointed out by foreigners, but were never seriously analyzed because at that time Japan was less prominent and influential, and few people had paid attention to these problems. The Japanese, for their part, did not make an effort to lead foreigners to understand them by elaborating upon their concept, practices and customs, which may be complicated and quite different from those of the West. It is partly because of the language barrier, and partly because the Japanese were perhaps too busy pursuing their materialistic goal. I have seen so many instances of mutual misunderstanding or indigestion of discussions between Japanese and foreigners due to a language problem, but more so because of the gaps in culture and perception. As the Japanese economy has become more prominent and influential internationally and tends to be more open, Japan as a whole is prone to be exposed to the eyes of other nations in various ways. For instance, in shifting manufacturing bases overseas, we may now have to consider exporting Japanese management concept or philosophy. We are now asked by more and complicated distribution systems and price structures are queried. Various pressures from overseas have become serious threats to Japanese as they may affect the fundamentals, social structure, conventional wisdom, value concept, etc. The Japanese have started to realize that dialogue, the exchange of opinions and ideas has become essential. Through the process of exchanging views with the other nations, the Japanese public in general also has become more conscious about their private lives, which up to date were secondary matters to their business lives. The Japanese regarded their country as a place of production and were slow to improve arrangement for living. Value judgments have become diversified, especially in urban dwellers' assessment of the quality of life. For instance, the price of food and housing is outrageously high, and social infrastructure is inadequate. In this respect, although per capita GNP converted to US dollars by market exchange rate now surpasses that of the United States, nobody in Japan feels that we are better off than the Americans. People have begun using more than one yardstick for value judgment. Japan has been exposed in the spotlight of the international scene quite suddenly and unpreparedly, virtually for the first time in the last 40 years. Japan, in a way, is currently perplexed, having achieved the goal of economic development and now facing the new situation. On the other hand, perhaps, Western people are also perplexed by the emergence of an industrialized nation which often has different concept of value judgment from the concept or value judgment from Western people. In these circumstances, exchange of opinions and efforts to understand each other becomes more essential. It will take time and effort, and perhaps at times pain. It is encouraging to learn that more Japanese people nowadays visit and study overseas at younger age and vice versa. I can confirm this tendency through my small contribution to the Rotary Club of Melbourne. Last but not least, Japan, as I repeatedly mentioned, has paid much of its attention to the West. The situation may have been the same for the other countries in the Asian region. I sincerely hope that through implementation of various kind of assistance programs, the human aspect of mutual understanding will also be developed. I believe for the prosperity of the Asian Pacific region, we need to further develop stronger horizontal ties in this part of the world. I also believe that Japan will change its interpretation of internationalization as achieving the materialistic goal in the Japanic manner to something more of a mutual nature. greater understanding. Communications and understanding, no doubt, determine the distance between the nations. Thank you.
To adjourn at say 3:25, which gives us about 15 minutes for discussion, and I hope that someone will pursue that suggestion this morning about third world debt in the course of the forum. So it's over to you, ladies and gentlemen. Yes.
Progress of the many and the poverty of the most. Which brings me to the first speaker's paper, where talking of human development, he mentioned communication and how the banking system really does develop humanity, especially those involved in the banking system. And I mean, and he meant too, not just in that one firm, but all the ancillary organisations. Seems there progress for the many, but tremendous poverty for the few because of this third world debt. History doesn't impress me too much from 1980 to 1986. 1980, the third world debt was something like $453 billion. By 1986, the third world had paid of that debt about $658, from memory, billion, including interest plus capital. That's a 53% increase over the original debt that's been paid back. By 1986... the third world debt had almost doubled. So history doesn't seem to be in our favour. So I ask the bankers, any suggestions?
Would you like to lead off, Mr. Bailey? Or should I make a few observations while you're thinking about it?
I think the subject's pretty much to the fore of our minds, probably. I do appreciate the way you introduced the subject, knowing that having said all those nice words, you are then going to pass the hot potato. But it is an exceedingly difficult problem, this one. And I think if you go back in history, you have to go back before the last 6 years. You have to go back to when it all started. And when it all started, the intermediaries in the process were recycling through the world funds which had become very large in the hands of the Middle Eastern countries, where the petrodollars that started the whole process were, and passed them on to people in other countries to encourage development. Unfortunately, the money went all right, but the product of the money was not considered in the widest possible terms. It was all very well. The money itself was used for purposes. And where it was used to encourage a developing country to produce goods, the people that were applauding the money going there were not willing to enact the necessary follow-up to enable free trade to flow from that and thus justify the, and to thereby justify the expenditure and enable the world to progress. And I suppose that's one of the great problems of this, is that the money that was used in developing countries for productive purposes, the outputs of that production have not been accepted by the rest of the world. So I don't think it's totally a banking problem. I think it's a global problem, and it involves more than just banks. Hand in glove with that, certainly there are countries in the world that haven't got one hope in heaven of paying back what they have. And I think this is where we need to pull out a rifle, not a shotgun, and start addressing the issues of those countries in front of the others. There are other countries who, well run, well managed by themselves, would be great economic powers, who are not, through the indecisiveness within their community, the exploitation within their own borders, where there is more wealth being held by fewer people than other parts of the world. And that's an internal problem that somehow has to be addressed. There are nations who ought to be very big economic powers. They've got it all. They've got people resources, which is enormously valuable. They've got productive resources, and they've got natural wealth. Now, to address those countries on the hypothesis that we ought not to ask them to pay their debts would bring down the fabric of international commerce, trade and finance. It's a massive problem. I think we've got to start addressing it by those countries that have no hope. I could mention some in sub-Saharan Africa, which frankly ought to be forgiven the bulk of their debt. There are other ones who ought to have the world community make them face up to the fact that they have got a responsibility to service things which they have got the inherent ability to service. So when we talk about LDC debt, I think we need to start breaking it up. It's not one thing, it's the combination of many. I'm very sympathetic to interest capping, forgiveness of part of the debt, incentives to have people address the issue, because the issue is not going away, and if it doesn't get addressed soon, there will be some major impacts on it, and you could see the collapse of the world finance. In the worst scenario, you can see the collapse of the world financial system. Because if major banks cannot have to write off large sums of money, the whole world goes down. So it's all very well, too, as I say, there's an interdependency in this that goes far beyond banks, and goes far beyond banks that claim they have no exposure to LDC. There's an interdependency in the banking system which flows onto the interdependency of governments. And I think it's an international issue of the highest order. But as a banker, I do say, yes, there's a lot more we could be doing rather than talking about it, and certain countries could be taken as examples, and a far bigger degree of compassion shown to them. And I'm not just saying that here, I've said that in international forums, so that's my personal view and the view of my bank. Doesn't solve the problem, I might add, because we're a minnow in the banking scene in the world. Do you want to add to that?
I think I'm going to perhaps usurp the Chairman's prerogative by saying that we do tend to overlook the basic underlying reason for the third world debt problem, and it all goes back to December 1973 when the world price of oil quadrupled, and that was called the first oil shock, and we've had a series of oil shocks in the latter part of the 70s and the early part of the 80s. At that time, huge surpluses accrued to the oil-producing countries, and the oil-consuming countries incurred huge deficits. The oil producers were so rich that they decided not to take any risks, but to put their funds on short-term deposit with the international banks. The international banks were faced with a dilemma because of the tremendous demand for loan funds, or recycling, as Mr. Bailey said, of those surpluses from the oil consumers. On the one hand, they had short-term deposits from the oil producers, a big demand for long-term borrowing funds from the oil consumers. Had they not recycled, we might well have had a crisis of greater proportions than we've got now back in the late 70s. They recycled, and of course today they're criticised with all of the blinding clarity of hindsight. But the basic problem, I don't think, has disappeared, because today we have the same level of imbalance in the world economy almost as we had in the middle 70s because of the huge surpluses generated by Japan and Germany and the huge deficits generated by countries like Australia, but more particularly by the United States. And I suppose if the United States were not such a gigantic economy, it could well be the third world debtor of the future, and may yet well be, unless we find some way of solving this huge problem of the imbalances. We've seen massive exchange rate adjustments. When I went to Tokyo in September 1985 to open a branch of my bank, the exchange rate for the Japanese yen against the Australian dollar was 240. Today it's a little over 90. Now that's a massive adjustment. But Japan, I think, Tom, is still in surplus with the rest of the world. The adjustment against the US dollar is of similar proportions. So we've not yet solved the problem. And it is very easy for us to blame the governments and blame the banks. I heard a very prominent central banker at a conference last year say it might be easier if the central bankers could meet without the politicians. I don't pretend to know what the solution is, but the problem is still there. Do you want to add anything, Tom?
I think there's, as Mr. Bailey and Mr. White said, the problem is too huge. But if we look at what's happening now in the international market, it's being adjusted in many ways. For instance, Japanese life insurance companies investing on papers, securities in US, Australia, Canada. Now, we face appreciation of yen, and through this mechanism, insurance companies are facing huge capital loss, I mean exchange loss. Now, this is one form, I think, of recycling money to other places. And one other instance is that American banks are building up provisions to write off third world debt. Now, it just started, but I think it will eventually be done with the other Japanese banks, perhaps in a smaller way. But this is another way of recycling funds. So, to my mind, both parties, lenders and borrowers, in a way, sacrificing to a certain extent. And for the banks, if we have to write off some of the debt, then we have to make profit somewhere else. So it's the same enormous effort as the developing countries are trying to meet the service debt and try to develop its economy.
Yes, Mr. Jaime would like to make a comment.
Not being in the chair, I feel I have greater liberty now to participate. And perhaps being the one Asian country with perhaps one of the more serious external debt problems, I'd like to bring in a new perspective from a developing country's point of view and a debtor at that. Perhaps it's all very well for